interview with Florence Soltis by Natalie Fusakis for the Southern Oral History Program on November 4th, 1998, at her home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I'm here to talk with her about issues related to the elderly in North Carolina from World War II to the present. This is tape number 11498FS.
Well, actually, two of them do that one and that one.
Yeah, a lot of places have that.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with when and where you were born?
Well, I was born in the country, in Tennessee. My dad was a farmer in August of 1935. So I was a Depression child and first in my family and first grandchild.
Wow.
On my dad's side of the family, and my grandmother, I was the only grandchild out of her many children and grandchildren that had red hair. And she had auburn hair, so I was always her favorite. And spent a tremendous amount of time with her as a child. She was a gardener, loved a garden, and I would go and spend a week with her, I can remember, and her infinite patience with me in the garden, teaching me what was what. But I remember once when I weeded her garden for her, I pulled up all of her flowers. And it's the one time she ever spanked me. She was so upset. And then I think she felt terrible.
Did she live in the same town as you?
She lived probably 2 or 3 miles away. It wasn't that far away.
That's great. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one brother and 2 sisters. Yeah. And I'm the oldest. My brother is 2 years younger than I, and I have a sister 5 years younger and a sister 11 years younger. So in some ways, they were like older children because they were little kids when I went off to college, really.
Right.
So.
Where were your parents from?
My parents were Southerners. My dad's family, in fact, I have a book written about the family called The Gray Ghosts. They were Virginian originally and then settled in Tennessee in the eastern part of the state. And my mother was a Hill, H-I-L-L. And her family had come from North Carolina. I really don't know a lot about that particular grandfather. He never really talked that much. But my grandmother and he were enormous landowners. And a lot of the land that they owned, I think it was several thousand acres at one point, were taken in by the park, Smoky Mountain Park, Cades Cove, and all that area. So that both families were original to that area for many generations, you know, their old family cemeteries. And my dad's family cemetery, actually, they moved some of the graves. They go back to the Revolutionary War, which, you know, they were moved from Virginia.
Right.
Which surprised me. I didn't realize that until recently.
Oh, that
when I was visiting with when I was visiting with my 85-year aunt, who's the only family member left in my dad's generation. And we'd gone to she took my younger daughter to the graveyard, sort of to give her a little bit of linear education.
Right.
And also me as well.
Right, right.
And my mother's family's graveyard, I think, goes back, it's the mid-1700s, I think. It's the earliest grave I saw there. So they're both old-timers in the area. And we're sort of related to everybody there, though the area's starting to change.
Right. And what did your father do?
He was a farmer.
And what kind of farm did you guys do?
Well, it was multiple, but the basic source of interest was dairy, except in his later years when he couldn't get help, and it's so labor-intensive.
Yeah.
He actually sold off all the equipment and didn't run it anymore. He ran beef cattle. And the other thing he left was horses. As a matter of fact, he died 3 years ago, soon before. And his last day on this earth, and I was so pleased about it, was that he chopped wood and went riding on his horse and then developed a pain and went to see his internist and started to stand up to go into see him and fell dead.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, how lucky can a person be?
Right, if you're going to just go, you might as well.
And he was always riding horses. As a matter of fact, he actually would break them, you know, teaching them to ride until he probably was 80. And my brother would say to me, he's going to kill himself. And I said, look, he'll die happy. He wants to do it. I'm not going to worry about it.
Right, right.
So he remained. In fact, he had a coronary in his 50s. But then he was quite healthy until he died at 84. So you can't complain about that.
No, you can't. That's
I he mean, was very lucky.
That's a great lifespan.
Yeah,
I'll take that any day.
My mother died much younger.
That's
yeah. So he, in fact, she died 20 years before he.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
And he lived. Did he live in the same town?
Where he stayed in the family house. He remarried about 2 years afterward.
Okay. Where did you go to school?
I went undergrad to the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. And I majored in nutrition and institutional management because I'd been involved in 4-H and a variety of activities like that, so it made a lot of sense.
Right.
And I would go to the state university and sort of continue that. And originally I had thought that that's what I wanted to do, was to stay in the rural area and actually work with, in many ways, working in extension is a lot like social work, but, you know. But I decided to do the nutrition track, which because I really enjoyed it, if I could... You can believe the chemistry and the classes in nutrition. And my professors there really pushed me to do graduate work in nutrition because they really felt that was the way I should go. And so when I graduated, I applied two places. One was New York City and the other was Boston. And I was very lucky in those days. You didn't take GREs or anything. It was just on recommendations and in grades. And got in both places. And you'll probably laugh about how I made the decision whether to go to Mass General or Columbia Presbyterian, because these are dietetic masters in hospitals. And I decided to go to Boston because when I looked at the map, it was closer to Harvard than the other school. So that's how I made the decision.
Well, that's not a bad idea.
And two of my classmates, actually joined me out of 12 people that they accepted in the graduate class. So we made up a third of the class, or a fourth of the class.
From Tennessee?
Right.
Wow.
Right. There was like this movement back and forth between those two places.
Right.
Which I think because of the professors being friends. And I was very much pushed to sort of go to the Mass General. And people said to me, that's where you want to go.
About what year was this?
That was 58.
Okay.
So it was a long time ago. And I, from the minute I stepped my foot in Boston, I fell in love. You know, seeing the public garden, and we lived on Cumberland Avenue in this beautiful brownstone that had been the Herricks, who had been the ambassador to England during the Second World War. It was magnificent. And they'd given it to the Mass General, and they used it for housing for us, so it was just gorgeous. And just walking through the public garden down Charles Street to the Mass General every day, it was just such pleasure. And then the excitement of just learning, and it was such an active hospital and so marvelous. And then they employed me, and I had the great luck of working with people like Jocelyn in diabetes, who was the world expert, Paul Dudley White, the cardiologist, who was world-renowned, etc.
Right.
I mean, they tolerated a kid who was in her early 20s working with these great men. I sometimes think about it and laugh. I think I'm amazed they put up with me. But then, you know, I met my husband also when he was a medical student.
At Mass General?
When I was there.
So what is the most memorable thing about these great doctors that you had contact with?
Well, I think the humaneness, the consistency of really caring about people, the kind of role models that they were. And despite how world-renowned they were,
they
never showed. There was never this ego trip.
Right.
And this toleration and this tremendous, I think both of them, they were older at the time I knew them, and I think both of them had this need to teach, to leave behind the wisdom that they had accumulated, which I have so often thought about and thought how lucky I was to have had crossed the paths where they were.
Right.
And then one of the other people that I used to spend a lot of time with, I think it was a beginning of reinforcement of my interest in geriatrics, was John Rock. And I don't know if you knew who Dr. Rock was or not, but he discovered the birth control pill.
Okay.
And he had been a Catholic and had been excommunicated from the church. And in those days, patients could stay in the hospital forever. So Dr. Rock was old, he was widowed. He was cognitively very alert, but physically not. And if I didn't go visit him every day, and he was there for months, he would call me in my office. I want to know why I hadn't been by to visit him. And he would sit me down and really tell me all these stories about his life. I was so sorry I didn't record them. But I often think back because he would say to me, now Florence, you're only 23 or 24, I can't remember what I was now, but anyway, very young. And he said to me, when you're 50 and 60, you think back about me and the time that I've spent talking to you, and I will have done more to change society and give women the ability to make choices than anything else you'll be able to identify.
Wow.
He had somewhat of an ego, but he also knew that what he had done would really impact on society. And I've often thought about that, and I think he probably was right.
Oh, sure.
I have not been able to identify anything else that I think was more. And he would talk to me a lot about his wife, and she had long been dead, and he really missed her. And he'd talk about his early days, and, you know, it was great fun. And I think that was my beginning of having a lot of interest in people's stories and older people and sort of honoring their lives, etc.
Right.
He and my grandmother, and then he.
Wow. I love sitting and listening to stories
that. Yeah.
How exactly did you meet your husband?
That's a funny story.
I was like.
At the Herrick House, I had two roommates. We had these enormous bedrooms, and there were three of us in the room. And my roommate had been going out with this medical student. And I had actually been going out with one of his classmates. Well, before that, I need to tell you another story, and then I'll go back to
that. That's great. Fine.
But before that, I was dating a Harvard law student. And he had been down to Cuba when Castro, he was one of the students that went down to help Castro take over the government. And actually, Castro came to Boston.
I think my
young,
mother,
dashing, charming man. And I met Castro because of him.
My mother met him,
reception.
Too. That same, my mother was at Wellesley at about the same time.
Probably was
there.
At the same reception over at the law school.
Yeah.
Your mother could remember being marvelous.
She talked about how dashing he was.
Oh, he was absolutely going to charm the flies off the wall. But anyway, I had been going out with him, and then I'd gone out with one of John's classmates. And I grew up as a Protestant. I think I never really thought very much about, you know, stringencies of religions and
that sort
of thing. But the young man that I was dating was Jewish, and his parents were very religious. And they did not want him to go out with me anymore. And so we sort of weren't going out anymore. And my roommate had been dating his classmate. She was very Catholic, Irish Catholic. This whole thing got very confused.
Right, everyone's religious.
And she was going out with this young man that she said was Jewish, who was my husband. And her parents were objecting to her going out with him. And one night when he was at the Mass General, he'd gone to a neurology party because he had rotated, this is my husband John, through the neurology. And he had had what he felt were too many drinks to drive. So he called Pat and wanted to go out, and I answered the phone. She wasn't there. So he said, would you go out and have a cup of coffee with me, just so that I feel okay to drive back to the medical school, which is only about 2 or 3 miles away. And I said, sure, but I didn't think Pat would mind.
Right.
So I went out and had a cup of coffee with him, and we sort of never dated anyone else after that.
Wow.
And then we were married in June of 59.
In Boston.
When he finished medical school. No, we were married in Tennessee. But he was not Jewish. In fact, he was Catholic. His parents were Austria, you know, as I said, from Austria-Hungary, Hungarian Empire.
So how did you all get down to North Carolina?
How did we come to North Carolina? Well, John did an internship, actually, in Chicago, because that's where he was matched when he graduated. So I was over at Presbyterian St. Luke's in Chicago, and he was at Michael Reese, which no longer exists on the south side of Chicago. And we lived in I'm blocking the name of the apartment complex, on the south side, which was the first experiment in this country in integrated housing done by New York Life Insurance.
Oh, wow.
And they kept it at, you know, ratios, and you were interviewed before you were allowed to it's right on the lake, and directly 2 blocks from Michael Reese. And that was a very good experience for both of us.
How so?
In that we developed friendships with a lot of black couples that we still hear from to this day at Christmas time, you know, 40 years later. But it was very positive in that it gave us a perspective that neither of us had from our backgrounds. I knew a lot of black people growing up in the South. I knew them as friends. As a matter of fact, on the farm, we had an older black couple. He lived to be 98. He died when I was in college. And we called him Uncle Wash. His name was George Washington Stokely. And his wife was Lizzie, and we called her Aunt Lizzie. But Uncle Wash used to take my brother and I out. He would babysit for us when he was, well, late 80s. And he would take my brother and I out fishing. He loved to fish, and we'd go fishing with him at the pond on the farm. And he used to sit us on his knee, or we'd sit with him fishing, and he'd tell us stories that he could remember from his mother, who was a slave.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure he could remember them himself.
Right, right. But he
probably been repeated to him. But he was absolutely a fascinating man. And then, of course, when I would make cookies or something like that that you could throw against the wall and break the house down, he would always admire everything I did.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting. So, but it was on more, I think our going to Chicago was more on a different level.
Right.
Of course, you're at a different place in your life then, too. And these people were professionals. They were peers, etc., which made a difference. But we were there 1 year when you were coming back to Boston. So he went back to Boston and he did his residency and all his training there.
And what were you doing at this time?
I was back at the Mass General, working and back over to the hospital.
As a nutritionist?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Working still with sort of, I just was gone for a year and came back and moved back in.
Oh, that's great.
And worked in Phillips House in Great Park, which is the private part of the hospital. It's on the Charles, and, you know, it's where the elite sought health care. And it was fun. I mean, you had, in those days, in the 60s, it would be unusual. If a patient wanted watermelon in January, you call Florida and ordered watermelon in January. And we had Crystal and Lennon's and all that sort of thing to go out. So it was a lot of supervision of a lot of PR kind of thing, as well as working with the physicians. Many of their patients would be internationally known people that, you know, they'd be taken care of, that I would work with too. So the experience was not with a lot of poor people that I had had the experience before, but I still was working with Dr. Paul Dudley White, et cetera.
Right.
Those physicians. This was the other end of their practice.
Oh, okay.
And no students were there.
So
it was a little different. The rest of the hospital was a teaching hospital, but that part was not. So it was fun because of the people you met and sort of the joys of it. Occasionally it was very frustrating, but I stayed there. And then the desegregation in the Boston schools started. And there were riots and problems and all this sort of thing. And I decided that I would go see the people in the education department, and if they needed a white person to go into the black community, then I would go. And I talked to them, and indeed they did. So I taught for 3 years in Roxbury, which at Girls High School, which is a black school, which they were trying to integrate, and there were very few white students there. But I had a principal who wasn't, and this, I taught, this is high school, so the students were older. I taught third and fourth year of high school. And it was basically life skills is what it wound up being, because these kiddos were so far behind and socially had problems, came from really serious problemed homes, etc. But I loved them. I mean, they were marvelous. In those days, they had what was called reform schools,
mm-hmm.
where when a child was incorrigible, they were sent off to reform school. They were segregated by gender, as were the schools in Boston at that time, once you got to high school level.
They were segregated by gender?
Yes.
Wow.
So this was girls' high school. It was only girls. And what was interesting was that by then, John was sort of into his last years of residency, and he was consulting to a number of these reform schools. So I would have him in my class, and then he would see them in the reform school when they'd be sent off because they had misbehaved. So it was kind of funny.
Oh, gosh.
But I remember one incident And my principal said to me one day, as long as you're reasonable, because I wanted to take them on field trips. I wanted to take them to places like the art museum and et cetera, where, you know, Boston is just so abundant in these things. They'd never been outside their community. So I went to the principal and I said, you know, I know this is not maybe, but I really feel like they need socialization and exposure. And she said to me, as long as you don't get the school in trouble and you're feeling that they're learning, you do what you want. That, this was after she got to know me. And one of the things that I still, occasionally I ran over the article the other day when I was looking for something. Shreve Krempenlow, which is the store in Boston, or used to be. I'm not sure it even exists anymore. Had magnificent things, antiques and very expensive things. And each year they sponsored a contest with the Silversmiths of America where high school students would come in and develop a menu and choose from anything in their store and set a table. And the school that won would then, for the next 20 years, be given a place setting of sterling silver to the outstanding senior graduating, and big silver tray service for the school. So I read about this, and I said to my principal, I said, you know, I think I'm going to take my students to the store and have them visit, and then I think I'm going to have them enter the contest. And she said to me, and this, of course, competed with Wellesley and Weston and all these fancy schools. And she said to me, Florence, if you have the courage to do it, go ahead. But you better make sure their hands are in their pockets when they're in the store.
Right.
I hope you don't get too embarrassed.
No.
So I took this, I called up Shreve and I talked to them. I knew some people there and talked to them. And they said, no, we'd be glad to do that. With all the trouble that was happening in Boston, they dared not say no. So I took the students on a field trip, and they were wonderful to them. They really were very gracious. So then I decided, well, I'll have them enter the contest. So I selected, and I couldn't go help them.
Right.
They had to go on their own. I had to pick a team, and they went on their own. So I picked a team of students, and some of the better students and some of the poor students, because I wanted to have them sort of learn from each other. But I could help them develop the menu. And so we talked, we'd have a Boston theme, Massachusetts theme, and so we picked things like Harvard beets, because Teddy Kennedy had just come out about his cheating at Harvard. Boston cod and stuff like this.
Right.
And they decided you had to choose who would do this dinner not in honor of, and they decided Ted Kennedy. So the Harvard beets was sort of a joke.
Right.
And so the students went down, and I think they must have helped them at Shreve's because they knew how brave they were. But anyway, they chose the china and the silver and set this table. And they took little silver cordials and put the state flower in.
Right.
And then they decided they'd use American flag on one end and state flag on the other. And they couldn't find a small state flag, so they just marched themselves up to the Secretary of State's office and asked to borrow his, which he graciously gave it to them. And my students won. There were all these articles in the paper about it and about these students winning this. And my principal was so pleased. And, of course, the students, for years, received the sterling silver place setting. They graduated from the school. This top student in the school suddenly had all this silver, as the principal said, and no place to put it.
Right.
But
wow,
it was very nice. I really, you know, the article I noticed the other day when I was going through some things. But those are kind of things that you remember, and I remember a lot of students who were immigrants that were coming over during that time, for whom English was not their first language, and they're sitting with the dictionary translating and trying to catch on, and many of them were so motivated that they would wind up being really good students by the end of the year, but they were mixed in with all these students with really serious problems. I think it's also a time when you begin to realize how maybe mainstreaming is not the best way to educate children.
Right.
Somehow you have to give people supports. And in my laboratory, we have these huge room-long soapstone sinks. And somebody from the school board probably had been in cahoots with the old Octagon soap, because I had a whole closet full of it. And I used to put it out for the students. And I still remember one of the black students, everything's very quiet and they're washing their hands. And she speaks up and she said, "Mrs. Soltis." And I said, "What?" She said, "You know, I'm going to turn white in your class one of these days if I keep having to use this soap." So there are all sorts of funny things like that that I can remember.
What motivated you to do this in the first place?
I don't know. I enjoyed, when I was at the Mass General, I then started having some, I wasn't responsible for a full class at the Mass General, but I was having students rotate through with me on projects and things. I really enjoyed the teaching part. And I was feeling very badly that, you know, there was all this problem in the schools.
Right.
And people weren't coming forward to do anything to attempt to rectify it. I felt very mixed about it because I also felt that the burden was being put only on the poor people in the city.
Right.
While the suburban areas were standing back and yelling, "Oh, look at those animals," so to speak. Both white and black. You know, sort of the, basically, that's what they were calling the Irish from South Boston and so forth. But they were all poor. And they didn't, you know, they didn't have the family support, the economics and all that. I was very frustrated by the whole thing. But I loved the 3 years I was there. And then I became pregnant. And our older daughter stopped my teaching career. And then I stayed home for the next 15 years and volunteered probably 20 to 30 hours a week in a variety of things.
And where were you at this point? Were you still in
Boston? I was still in Boston. Oh, golly, some of the things I did there. I was the Y board when a lot of things were happening in Boston on the Y. That's when it was still very, very prominent. We had a community organization. We then bought an old house in Boston in 68 that had a lot of work to be done to it, which we did, which I did a lot of it myself. But we had a neighborhood organization, and I was elected president of that, which was the first woman. It had been a male-dominated thing.
What kind of stuff, early
70s.
What kind of stuff did you do?
Well, we did things like run all sorts of programs for the young people in, you know, like brownies and hockey and all
right.
that sort of thing. We monitored, for instance, the policing. We made sure that politically that people, we would encourage people to vote. At one point, we were having lots of house breaks. We were able to convince the mayor to put a policeman and a dog in our neighborhood, which one policeman and a dog, and no one knowing when they were working, the house breaks went from 350 to 2 in a year.
Oh, wow.
Just effectiveness of that. Just lots of issues that came up. There began to be a push from a lot of developers to come in with high-rises around the local park system. And I participated in a task force that the mayor appointed, which is still quoted in a lot of the literature, called the Charles to Charles Cabot Estate, in which we set guidelines for a lot of city and height and all that sort of stuff in neighborhoods. And then things became worse and worse throughout the city. So then what we did was organize the entire city and all the neighborhood organizations and start to look at things in a more holistic way. And I chaired that, and it represented close to 300,000 people. So it really required a lot of time. It also gave you a lot of access to people that you wanted, like Ted Kennedy and Barney Frank and people like that,
right.
The mayor.
Wow.
It's how I became friends with Michael Dukakis, who later became governor. I knew him when he was a selectman in Brookline. So that I knew a lot of people in Boston. I knew how many of them connected, and sort
right.
of it was like a city where I could go anywhere, and I... It's a series of neighborhoods,
right?
Which was so exciting about it. And so I was very committed to the city. I love the city, and it was home for me.
Right.
Almost from the day I put my foot there. And then in 1975, one of the people from the university here, I can't remember if John met him at a meeting or what, but the AHEC program was just starting here. It had was really not... terribly progressed. They were real interested in expanding the psychiatry program.
Okay.
And AHEC, of course, is the program that reaches out over the state
okay.
for continuing education, for consultation, for clinical services, etc. And it started with federal monies just with the medical school. And it's in, I think, 73 or 74. So it was quite young.
What does AX stand for?
Area Health Education Centers.
Okay.
And it then later, North Carolina eventually took the model and put it in all the health science schools and also includes social work now. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes because I was involved in that. But they talked to John because he had done community psychiatry. He did adult psychiatry, child psychiatry, and then community psychiatry with Kaplan. You know, he was going to school all these years. But anyway, they wanted somebody in community psychiatry to come here to expand the program out over across the state because the community mental health centers weren't really caught on yet, et cetera. They were dumping out the hospitals. So anyway, we came down and he talked to people and back and forth, and then the chairman came up to Boston and came to talk to us, and our younger daughter misbehaved terribly. I figured he wouldn't ask John to come. But anyway, she was two, and she threw a tantrum at dinner.
As two-year-olds do.
Yeah, exactly. And he was very gracious about it, but I was horribly embarrassed. But I would much rather she would have thrown it when he weren't here.
Right.
But anyway, they offered him the job, and after much thought and many tears, we came because I just had a real hard time with it. And Chapel Hill was a different place in 75 than it is today.
How so?
There were, as I recall, three restaurants in the town. There was a little Chinese one out on 15501 that's now defunct, near a motel there. And there was Brady's Fried Chicken, where Sienna is. Villa Teo and Ratskeller's. There were four.
Wow.
And Carolina on Franklin Street.
Right.
So there were those, and that was it. It was very much a black and white society. There were almost no ethnic backgrounds. And remember that, and I didn't know this at the time, but in fact it was not until 1965 that the university integrated.
Right.
A lot of blacks to come in. And in fact, I later became very good friends with Hortense McClinton, who was the first black faculty person to come to UNC. She had come, I believe it was in 66, 67, and she told me when she came, she had to use a separate bathroom, couldn't eat in the restaurants, etc.
Oh my.
So, and if you're interested in reading about it, there's a great book by John Ely, E-H-L-E, called Brave Men, which is an accounting of what happened here during the 60s and you'll be interested in some of the names and activities, and there were trials and all sorts of things. I mean,
right,
it was very
right.
ugly. Apparently, if his account, and I assume his account is correct. But it was coming from a very multi-ethnic background. For a long time, we had food shipped down to us from Boston of various ethnic foods.
I can relate to that.
Like pita bread and grape leaves and things like that, of things that we had always enjoyed. And kind of an interesting story, our older daughter was 11 years old.
What's her name?
Jacqueline.
Okay.
Was 11 years old at the time. She was in the 7th grade and she went to Culbreth. And my kids had always been accustomed to eating ethnic food, so I think she took something to school and pita bread. And I can't remember what else. Whatever it was she wanted, she took. Anyway, she came home in tears because the classmates made fun of her because they'd never seen food like that. So it's sort of an example of, the way society was here. Schools were very poor at that time. My kids had gone to the Boston Public. I had sent them to the public school, but it was a neighborhood school in which it was fairly good, I think. And Rebecca went to Glenwood. She was a first grader, a younger daughter. She fared better than Jackie because there was lots violence, I guess is the word I want to use. I was trying to find a better word. But in many ways, I realized maybe I'd overprotected the kids because they weren't accustomed to that. So Jackie would come home with these stories, and I started volunteering in the school because I wasn't working. And what I found was that she was correct. I started tutoring kids that were 16, 14, 16, who couldn't read and write. Multiplication tables may as well have been Greek. I started tutoring a one-to-one, probably 20 hours a week. the students, and classes changed, and it was like chaos.
No water or something?
I think I will if you want to turn it off. I'll get a glass. Can I get... but anyway, I was back to tutoring the students. I just was really distraught, and it finally wound up that I would go out between classes, and I had no authority. This just goes to show you that I maybe was overly aggressive. But I would say to the student, you have 30 seconds to get to your classroom, you know, and so forth, to really push students, because I felt they didn't have boundaries, didn't know where they stood. This really bothered me. So the more I was involved, the more I knew that it wasn't a place for my kids. Because I could see Jacqueline, our older daughter, had already skipped one grade.
Right.
And their solution was for her to skip another grade. And that would have let, I mean, she would have, she did graduate from high school at 16, but she would have been even younger.
Right.
And I felt socially she couldn't handle it. So I said to my husband, just to show you how desperate I was, I said, either the children go to a private school or I'm going back to Boston. This was how I felt.
Right.
And so we put them in Durham Academy, which was probably the smartest money we ever spent. Because they loved the school. As a matter of fact, Jackie went to the school, I was going to tell you the difference, with sort of ethnic food, and she came home the first day, and they don't have a lunch program, the kids take their lunches.
Right.
She came home the first day, and she was so excited, and she said, and I'm starving, and I said, did I not give you enough lunch? And she said, oh, the kids all ate it. Nobody had ever seen food like that, and they were so excited, everybody wanted to try things. So could I take extra tomorrow so they can all, you know, people can try it. She said, I just love it. Nobody said to me, that's weird and you're strange and all this. So those were very happy years, and my kids went through and graduated from there. And they say to me now, if we ever have money, we wanted to go to Durham Academy.
Right.
Not to the colleges and universities that they went to. But they saw that school as really shaping their character, particularly now that Jackie's 30, going to be 35 soon, and Rebecca's 27, so or 28, so that they have seen the importance and the devotion of the teachers. And when Jacqueline married, several of her high school teachers came. She was 28 when she married. It's been years since she was out.
Right.
And many of her teachers came to her wedding.
That's unusual.
Well, you know, I think that it speaks for the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard great.
And there were disadvantages because many of the kids were very well off, you know, where maybe the value structure was a little different from mine, the right labels, not what I wanted my kids to carry off as high values. But educationally, it was superb. I was out there the other day to take something, and the waiting list is so long now. The waiting list is long as the number of students in the school.
Yeah, I believe it.
Wow. So I think, you know, and they don't have land to expand. See, they're sort of hemmed in.
Right.
In Durham, where they are, there's no land.
Oh, that's too bad.
So they were talking to me about building a campus that would be somewhere in the country where they could expand. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not really on the board or anything, so I don't know.
Right.
But the other thing then, what I did after I was here for a year, was 76, I guess. Maybe close to 77. I think it was 76. There was a push to do Meals on Wheels. There was no program here.
Okay.
And the Episcopal Church... The Episcopal dioceses and some of the local churches really wanted to start this. And so, actually, I was the first coordinator. I ordered the filing cabinet, the telephone, and all that at Binkley Baptist, where we started, and put together the volunteers and all that. So that was great fun. And that program is still going. As a matter of fact, I'm going to speak in December, where I think it's the 22nd or something like that anniversary, whatever it is.
Wow.
22nd or 23rd.
So how many people did you serve when you first started?
We started out with five.
I think something about 60 now. And we set up a very different kind of program because, you know, the Older Americans Act will pay for Meals on Wheels, and the decision was made that they didn't want to be restricted to just older people because this was an academic community, and if young people, college students, needed meals delivered to them, they wanted to have it available. So we rejected federal money and actually raised the money, and it continues to be that way today.
Really?
Yeah. It's a very unique program. And we gave the federal money to the meals that are done in the congregate program.
Oh, that's good.
But I think it helped me begin to adjust to Chapel Hill and being involved in that, because I really got to know very large numbers of people because of volunteers. It forced me to go out over southern Orange County, where our catchment area was, and really learn a lot of people. And then working with the board was very interesting, too. They were a nice group of people. And then I did it for a year, resigned, and went on the board and became chair. So I was involved for a long time.
You're still there, even though you weren't doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I'm no longer now in any formal capacity. But it was an interesting time.
So how did you get from volunteering on Meals on Wheels to, you know, into the kinds of work that you're doing now?
Well, I did a lot of volunteer work for the Botanical Gardens, and I chaired a school bus safety task force in Chapel Hill because I was very concerned that 16-year-olds drove school buses. And the first year we were here, there were 22 school bus accidents in town. So,
wow. 16-year-olds drove school buses?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, there were more responsibilities put on 16-year-olds than there were teachers in the classroom because they would take 90 students on a school bus. So that got a fair amount of publicity, and I was called a communist for questioning this in North Carolina because these kids had driven tractors and all that and knew how to drive, but I thought it was inappropriate, and Ralph Nader got involved.
How did he get involved?
Well, I called.
Oh, very nice.
And Alexander, who was Secretary of Transportation at that time, actually threatened North Carolina with taking away their federal highway funds if they didn't do something because of the publicity that came out of this.
Right.
So that it wound up changing the training and the age of school bus drivers and so forth in North Carolina. So I thought that was fairly successful coming in as a newcomer. My kids weren't using the bus anymore even by the time, but I just was very concerned about it. And a lot of details I don't want to go into that were very political and so forth, but we don't have time. But that was interesting. And then across the street, in the house down this way, lived Martha Tippett. Her husband had been James Tippett, the children's writer.
Oh, yes.
The house directly across the street didn't exist then. It was woods.
Hold on a sec. I'm going to...
Okay.